Hello, and welcome to the Digital Works podcast. My name's Ash, and today I'm joined by my colleague and friend, Emily Childs. Hi, Em.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I think for full transparency, we should admit that this is the second go we are having at recording this podcast. And for the first go, I was under a table.
I can confirm he was under a table, and it was hilarious.
To be fair, I tweeted a photo of myself under a table. And the reason I was under a table is because I'm currently having to self-isolate because I went on holiday to Northern Italy. And we returned just before the entire country went into lockdown. But me and my partner do now have to self-isolate for 14 days. We're on day 4 because we have an open plan kitchen living room situation. I was trying to be clever and create an acoustically isolated little sort of pod under the table by covering the table in blankets. But in doing so, I ended up sort of bent over double because I'm quite long and the table wasn't high enough. And I was sort of pushing the microphone on my headphones into my mouth, which I think really resulted in quite a disgusting audio experience.
Yes.
So we are giving it another go. This time I am not sat under a table. I'm sat in a different room of the house, and hopefully this all sounds okay, although we are having to do this remotely, so it's not quite as neat and clean and tidy and professional sounding as when we go into a studio. But I was keen to get out the next episode of the podcast this week rather than have to wait another 2 or 3 weeks for my quarantine period to end. Anyway, that's a very long-winded and probably mostly unnecessary explanation, but I felt compelled to share that with everyone. So on today's episode, we've got an interview with Robin Christofferson, and Robin is an expert in digital accessibility. He is head of digital inclusion at AbilityNet. AbilityNet is an organization that aims to support people living with disability or impairment to use technology. And a lot of Robin's work involves working with companies, with corporations, with institutions to help them improve the accessibility of their digital tools and services. Robin actually spoke at Digital Works 9, and it was a very moving session that he gave. He did some really interesting sort of peering into the crystal ball and making some predictions about how he expects technology to evolve over the coming years. But I think what I found most impactful was when Robin shared the effect that technology has had on his entire life, on enabling him to live as full a life as he has done. And by the end of the session, he was in tears, I was in tears, Em, I think you were in tears.
It was
incredibly moving, and I think there's nothing more affecting and powerful than hearing about people's personal experience. And Robin is blind. He has a guide dog called Hugo who joined him at Digital Works. And that lived experience alongside his technical expertise, I think, makes him a really effective and engaging speaker on this topic. So we sat down, well, we didn't sit down. I spoke to him, like I'm doing with Emily today, over the internet just before Christmas. And we talked about a range of topics, from where Robin expects technology to progress to, through to characteristics of organizations that are doing digital inclusion and accessibility well. And we started our conversation digging into the concept that Robin introduced at the Digital Works event back in December 2019, the idea that we're living in an age of extreme computing experiences. You know, when you're stood looking at the internet on your phone using one hand and the sun's streaming in through the window, and you're on the bus and you're, you know, moving around as the bus goes around a corner, that is a quite heavily affected computing experience. And if we start to think about accessibility, or rather using Robin's preferred label of digital inclusion, and our goal is to make our digital tools and services more usable and accessible for everyone, then I think you really start to get a real handle on a better way into this topic. I feel like the language around accessibility has perhaps been as much of a barrier as anything in the past. But I think Robin has a really interesting, highly informed, and very personal perspective on all of this. So I hope you enjoy what he has to say when Robin and I spoke last year. Enjoy. The idea of accessibility, it feels that where it's less addressed, less engaged with, it's because people see it as a separate thing, an additional thing, a bolt-on. And I think the point that you made, that, you know, the fact that everyone is using computing devices on the move, things have touch screens, things have tiny screens, things have see-through screens. We're in an age where ambient computing interactions are growing, so that introduces a whole new array of constraints and possibilities. And I think thinking about accessibility in that context felt like people got it a lot quicker.
You know, platforms are only going to proliferate and become more extreme. You know, you're not going to be able to assume that there will be a screen involved, for example, or that people will be able to control the environment that they're in when they're accessing your services. So I think accessibility has got too much baggage, really. So we almost need to kind of move away from it, because people already know that it's hard and they think it's for disabled people only, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, digital inclusion being the kind of better way of looking at it, because then you're including everyone and it's not for those people over there. That's probably a useful point to get across, that it's much more for every user on a daily or even hourly basis. And then when you think about, well, why do people want to do things inclusively, you know, which in effect is following the accessibility guidelines, you know. So accessibility will feature, whether it's just in the kind of documentation that you're going to be dealing with, or your companies might be dealing with, to boil down into a smaller checklist that, depending on your role, is easier to handle. Because, you know, an editorial person doesn't need to know everything that's in WCAG, say. They just need to know the stuff that's kind of relevant to them. And ideally, it would be presented to you in a way that will make it easier for you to engage, and that will be relevant or specific to the tools and processes that you use within your particular team or your organization. So accessibility will kind of still be a thing, but it will no longer be something that you have to justify in terms of the carrots or the sticks. You know, the carrots are, oh, there's the purple pound and there's all those disabled people out there, et cetera, et cetera. It's the right thing to do. And the sticks are, look at the legal requirements, you know, it's the law, brand damage, all that sort of thing. But all of those arguments are aimed at, or in the context of, disabled customers and or employees. And so whilst the carrots and the sticks are very, very compelling and should be enough in themselves, they're still only framed in the context of disabled users. So we need to broaden that right out. The carrots are much, much bigger and juicier. It's not just to help disabled people access your services. It's to make your products better for every single user who are accessing them in extreme environments. Not only that they'll be able to successfully interact with them, juggling their phone one-handed, but that it'll be, you know, optimized UX. Because that's part of the, you know, digital inclusion, is that people have, you know, learning difficulties, cognitive difficulties. The usability needs to be of a sufficient level that somebody with those difficulties would be able to use them unsupported, and that's going to make the UX better for everyone. So there's so many reasons why it's better. And on the legal side of things, you know, it's still predominantly about the disabled user, but the brand damage is the big one. Because that's not just, you know, the likes of Domino's or Ryanair or someone who get hit in the press for treating their disabled customers poorly. So that kind of brand damage will carry on, but it's a much bigger one. You know, I think the XX app is pants because I can't use it. Have you ever tried to use that thing? You know, this thing pops up and it doesn't behave the way I want and stuff like that. All of those things, one would hope, had been run by end users before they go live. But what kind of end users? And certainly if you've got end users involved who had more extreme needs, then you'd get a product that was much better and more fit for purpose and just easier to use. So the argument on both sides expands right out when you start taking it on board for granted that it's not just for disabled people. And when it's seen as being table stakes, you know, to have a product that's fit for purpose in today's age, you've got to think about inclusive design. You know, it's just a no-brainer. So hopefully we'll get to that point at some point. The audience who are wondering, how seriously do I need to prioritize accessibility? Hopefully those kind of arguments will make them realize that, wow, we really need to start getting with this program, because going forward, it seems like it's going to be a necessary kind of skill set to have, a basic skill set to have, so that the stuff that we're creating isn't just rubbish for today's extreme computing age. Oh, and by the way, you'll get all of the kind of disabled and, you know, impaired users, older users, etc., able to access them as well.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir here. I don't need to be convinced, but I do think that just that shift in language feels like it just moves the perspective enough that certainly, when we had the event the other day at Digital Works, suddenly it felt like the penny dropped for a lot of people in the room. It wasn't just about WCAG, when it wasn't just about meeting a list of points of compliance, because accessibility is a good thing to strive for. That's the thing that's going to give the momentum to the discussion, is people really buying into this and driving it forward, and it not just being, as you said, a disabled person's priority. It is a priority about delivering excellent products and services for everyone. Mm-hmm. Because there's, you know, everyone is going to have a different level of ability to engage in those products and services, depending on the context, depending on, you know, how they are in that moment of interaction.
Yeah.
Are you seeing, because I mean, you have these sorts of conversations every day with, you know, numerous corporations and designers and people. Are you seeing a shift in language, a shift in how people are engaging with this topic? It feels like maybe previously, and please correct me if this is wrong, but accessibility was a slightly separate strand of thinking or discussion or activity. And certainly with the more progressive designers that I speak to and know about, it feels like, as you said, it's moved now from being, you know, design and then, oh, we'll make it accessible as a secondary conversation, to it being a conversation about inclusive design. Does that feel like a shift that's happening, or is it still,
Yeah, but not universally accepted. And I haven't heard much in, you know, the broader tech arena about the argument that, you know, the kind of extreme computing age argument. I don't hear that much at all. But certainly at TechShare Pro last month, the accessibility leadership panel was all saying stuff that's relatively new. I mean, the problem with these events is that all of the people that are there, you kind of talking to the converted, like you said a minute ago, you know, you're already on board. But you know, the stuff that they were talking about is so new. It's not that you need to have an accessibility person or an accessibility team within an organization, valuable as that is. They were talking in terms of an accessibility maturity model needs to be adopted on an organization-wide basis. And that would comprise, you know, C-level buy-in for accessibility or inclusive design, you know, call it what you will. But as far as the external kind of hearts and minds thing, I think accessibility is less useful a phrase than inclusive design, because we've been talking, you know, as we've been talking about a moment ago. But, you know, to have a champion at C level and at lower levels to, you know, within each team, arguably you need to have somebody who kind of owns that. But then every single team member needs to have training on it, needs to have, you know, everyone that's touching digital. And that could even be as part of every single employee's CPD or whatever, because they're sending emails internally even just, or doing a spreadsheet or something. And it's no longer acceptable to even put stuff around internally where disabled employees might struggle. So yeah, it's kind of a, the language has shifted even in the last 12 months or so towards, no, everyone needs to be on board. Everyone needs to have a base level of awareness and that sort of thing. So that's new.
Well, yeah, that sounds hugely positive. And
I don't know how widely adopted it is.
But I guess it has to start somewhere. And if you're observing that shift, then you'd hope that starts to gain momentum, becomes a more widespread way of talking about these sorts of things.
Hopefully, yeah. Even though the people in the room at TechSharePro were all already on board, you know, they've got to go back to organizations that will be in various points along that journey. So they hopefully can take those kind of messages back and try and get some buy-in. And certainly the public sector regs have been instrumental, I think, in certainly in the public sector anyway, making them engage with it much more than they did, even though it's been a legal requirement for a long time.
And I get that's an interesting point, because certainly we've seen it shoot up the agenda for clients, organizations that we work with, both in America with the Americans with Disabilities Act, and then over here with the public sector funded organization requirements that have come in the last 12 months or so. Mm-hmm. Have you, I mean, obviously that then suddenly puts it on everyone's radar because people don't want to be sued. But do you think that, to use your analogy, that stick, that quite big, heavy, scary stick with nails in, has that made people engage with this meaningfully? Or is it another tick box that they're just slightly more aware of, that they need to go through steps 1 to 10 and then they will be compliant and it's put back in the drawer? Or has it actually kickstarted better quality engagement with this set of priorities?
Well, when we have clients, prospective clients approach us, several years ago, it used to be, okay, we've heard about this accessibility thing. What do we need to do? As the conversation unrolls, it's like, okay, they basically want the minimum. So, you know, they don't care about it. They're not engaged with it, but they know they've got to do it. So, you know, and they end up not engaging us because they've got no budget for it. That hasn't been the case for many years now. People genuinely want to do the right thing. They may or may not have sufficient budget, or they may or may not have made the right choices previously to make it possible to achieve compliance on a particular project. But so in the public sector, everyone that's approached us is definitely not been a box-ticking engagement thereafter. Obviously, there's, I don't know, 14,000 independent public sector bodies that under this, you know, that they're affected by this legislation, and only a tiny, tiny proportion have contacted us or kind of had stories in the media or whatever. So I can't comment about the rest, but it definitely seems like they're engaging. Now, it's bizarre because it has been a legal requirement for arguably 2 decades, but, you know, it's only now they're really sitting up and listening. And I think the difference is because in this legislation, for the very first time, there is details about how it's going to be enforced. So like you said, you know, it's a stick with some kind of knobbliness to it. I'm not sure about nails, because so what's going to happen, I'm sure you're aware, the EHRC have been named as the body for monitoring, and the Cabinet Office potentially for enforcing, issuing fines and stuff like that. It's all very up in the air as to how many they'll be able to review. They haven't published their methodology or anything like that. And there is a massive number of organizations affected. So, but that I think has been enough to actually name a body. I mean, the EHRC arguably has been the body that should have been enforcing the Equality Act since 2010, but they haven't been. But I think for the first time, this is now named as a, you know, they are going to monitor. And because they're a public body themselves, they're subject to an FOI. So arguably that will, those, when they start that process, those things will be in the public domain if people just put in an FOI. So there's the brand damage potential, if not actual fines, but I'm hoping that there'll be fines as well. And there's been a lot of interest in other models like Norway and Spain and Australia that are being very proactive in the enforcement and issuing fines, hefty fines and stuff. And that's seeing a definite impact there. So the public sector probably know about those cases as well, and probably think that the EHRC could conceivably come in at the heavier end. I don't know if they will. So that feels real to them. And certainly there's massive uptake in public sector organizations contacting us. And so, yeah, let's hope there's a shift there, because digital government is a very real thing and everything's being driven there digital first. So they're going to leave a lot of people behind if they don't get with the program.
Yeah, absolutely. So moving away from the topic of compliance, really, I guess more to you've spoke about some of the events you've been to over the past, you know, year or so, where there have been demonstrations of new tech. You know, you showed us photos of flying taxis. You showed us photos of you wearing AR goggles. Mm-hmm. What you know, being immersed in that world of emerging tech, what are you excited about as someone who is very much a super user of a lot of this new technology? What are you seeing that's coming to market, or the developments that you've observed that you're really looking forward to being able to use?
The rise of AI. So in all its different forms, whether it's being able to interpret an image that hasn't been given a label in Twitter or on the web or whatever, or that I've got as an app that I can point my phone at, or whether it's in a smart speaker or built into glasses or whatever it might be. I mean, Amazon have created so many products that have the A-Lady built in. I'm not going to say a name. I've got one right here. Even a ring, you know. So that is a really exciting thing. So that's one kind of manifestation of AI where it's only going to help people with disabilities, for whom, you know, even if the website or the app itself is accessible, it's still going to take longer to interact with it than able-bodied people. It's just by the nature of the adjustment, it makes it possible, but it's probably not as efficient. The only exception of that is driving applications from the keyboard that have got really good keyboard support. You're inherently a much more efficient computer user if you're driving Word or Windows or whatever from the keyboard, because you've done the hotkey for it before you've even half reached for the mouse, let alone grabbed it, moved it, clicked it, put your hands back on the keyboard to carry on typing or whatever. So yeah, that I think natural language, natural interfaces, just talking to the air and getting useful information is going to be a big thing going forward. But also seeing AI in other areas like driverless vehicles, that's going to really democratize private transport, not just for the people that can afford a car, can use, you know, have can see well enough or have quick enough reflexes to pass a driving test, etc. So in the next 10 years, say, we're going to see a massive shift in car ownership from, I mean, Uber's kind of starting the trend. A lot of people don't see the point in owning a car now when you can just call one and they might not have a parking space in a city accommodation or whatever. It's just, you know, a bizarre concept to own a car in a London, for example. And I think we're going to see that spreading out to everyone, thinking how daft it is to own a car when you're only using it for a tiny percentage of the time. And so AI in driverless vehicles, in helping people hail them, in keeping them entertained and informed when they're in the vehicle, helping them, you know, what their next step is when they get out of the vehicle, if they can't pull them exactly right up to the door of the destination, etc. All those kind of things are going to be really useful. At the moment, blind people, say, need to have a human pair of eyes at the end of an app to help them with certain things. And I think AI is going to nibble into that increasingly going forward. It already has done to a large extent with just plain text or to recognize a particular product or something. But to the point where, you know, they'll be able to describe the meaning of a scene. So at the moment, the software can recognize loads of things that are in front of you, but they can't sort of look at the meaning of it and say, oh yeah, that's the door you want over there, or watch out for that, you know, park bench or something that's coming up. You know, at the moment it's just a cluster of objects and there's no kind of real smarts behind that. So yeah, I think that's going to be really big going forward as well. But all of these are going to be for everyone as well. They're not just going to be for disabled people, but because this age of extreme computing has arrived and, you know, something like driverless vehicles are definitely going to be subject to that, then they're going to be inclusive as well. Because if you're picking up someone in a driverless vehicle, it could be a child that's getting taken to school. It could be someone with early onset dementia, say, who has driven 300 miles from their care home to see relatives they don't see very often. And to be able to pop that person in the vehicle and know that they'll safely get to the destination without any reliance on that individual doing anything in the meantime. Or it could be that you're worse for wear after a good night out and you need to get a driverless vehicle back home or something. So there's loads of reasons why these services are going to have to be really inclusive and not reliant on the person having a certain technical ability or ability full stop, really. And disabled people will just be scooped up in that and, you know, benefit from it as well. So mainstreaming of inclusive design is a big thing going forward.
Yeah, and I mean, what you've just described there is a fairly significant shift in society, really. It's the future that you've described there is much more inclusive. As you said, a democratization of how people can engage with, move around, interact with the world around them through technology, which sounds so exciting. But do you worry at all that we are reliant on sort of private companies developing these products and services, and the design teams behind these products and services are not always as diverse and representative as they might be? Is that a concern? Is that, you know, as everything shifts, if that future is being built by a certain type of person, mm-hmm. who doesn't necessarily understand the truly transformative impact that their thing could have on the world, that there could be opportunities missed?
I think that certainly if you create products or services with a team that aren't themselves diverse, then you're going to get you're going to get embarrassing flaws in the service or uninclusive, exclusive products. Talking about AI, you know, there are some embarrassing examples of where early days Google image recognition flagged black people as apes and stuff like that. So, you know, or Apple, when they put out the iPhone 4, you're holding it wrong, antenna gate thing. I don't know if I mentioned this on the thing, because I'd done so many podcasts and presentations and stuff. I have no idea if I covered this at the Digital Works thing, but anyway, you know, that antenna gate thing, it had perfect reception in the California basin where there was loads of cell towers and it was all fine, but they never took it further than that. So they didn't realize that reception would be poor if you hold your phone, which obviously people will be holding their phone without a case sometimes, in areas where the reception wasn't as good as in California. So yeah, that's a problem. So yeah, you need to have a much broader idea of how you wrote, you know, it needs to be extreme testing, extreme design, extreme personas that you use, that you bear in mind when you're creating products and stuff like that. So yeah, we definitely agree with that. Going forward, that diversity hopefully is an ongoing agenda. That's, you know, the diversity agenda is much bigger than disability. It's gender, race, all that sort of thing, sexual orientation. And hopefully that's going to help create better products, more inclusive products going forward as well. But am I worried about it just being kept to the corporates? I think traditionally they do it better than government. DARPA, I don't know. I mean, that's obviously a US government kind of agency. And they've been responsible for almost all of the developments that we've been talking about, all created with military applications in mind. And yet we're benefiting from those advancements. So there's a, you know, you could say, well, that's not a good provenance for those technologies and, you know, technical advancements, but what can you say?
Anyway, exactly, the whole, as soon as you start pulling on the thread of where technical advances come from, it quickly unravels into this.
And, you know, face recognition, I'm super excited about, because it's going to help. As soon as I can get a pair of affordable head mounted smart glasses with a built-in camera that are socially acceptable enough, you know, I think there will be acceptance more broadly about head-mounted cameras, just as we're becoming more comfortable with having microphones always on in our homes and stuff like that. So as and when that happens, you know, I'm really looking forward to being able to use AI to tell me a lot about what's going on. And facial recognition, object recognition, text recognition, all that sort of thing is part and parcel of that. But move to China and you've got facial recognition, text recognition in the form of, you know, number plate recognition, all that sort of thing being used for really bad ends. So, you know, there's, like any tool, it can be used for good or ill.
And this feels like we're in a world where we're constantly treading this fine line between dystopia and utopia in terms of specifically technology. I am always inspired when I hear you talk about technology. And then, as you say, you look at much of the same tech being used by repressive regimes. And that is scary because it's the same technology in many cases just being used for different
exactly
things.
Exactly the same. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we've got these annual Technology for Good Awards, Tech for Good Awards, because we think it's nice to have only good news stories in an event to kind of showcase a dozen really, really good news stories, because tech is often seen as the bad thing, the bad guy, you know, taking over our kids' lives and harm online and all that sort of thing. So that's really good. We'd like to try and shift the agenda a little bit or rebalance it.
And a lot of the people listening to this will be people working in cultural organizations. I think, again, you're probably preaching to the choir with a lot of those sorts of organizations. They want to be reaching as many people as possible in a as meaningful a way as possible. They certainly don't want to be putting up barriers and actively working to remove them wherever they can. I wonder, in your work with people like Barclays and other big corporations who have significant, I would assume, resources to invest in this, are there, you know, aside from the money and time and headcount advantages, what are the behaviors or sort of ways of thinking? Are there any common themes across organizations that you work with that really get it? I would suspect that when you're working with someone that understands why inclusive design is an important and good thing, that is probably mirrored in lots of their other areas of activity. What's the question I'm trying to ask? I suppose I'm trying to...
Is it mirrored in the organization more broadly, kind of thing?
Yes, I think so. Like, you know, what behaviors should people be trying to identify and develop in their institutions, which is going to help serve this agenda and vice versa?
I think trying to convey the passion about why it's important would help change, you know, hearts and minds. It's difficult to know how to go about doing that if you suspect that your organization really isn't kind of that far along the journey to being excited and passionate about accessibility and inclusive design and diversity and that sort of thing. I mean, I suppose if you look around your organization and you can't see too many groups, you know, pertaining to different categories of impairment or sexual orientation or, you know, ethnicity or whatever, then you might think, well, this organization's probably earlier on in the journey. And in which case it's, you know, it is an uphill struggle. And we would hopefully just point you at online resources like the TechShare Pro sessions will all be going up on YouTube for people that weren't able to attend. And there's 2 days worth of sessions and breakout sessions that hopefully will persuade anyone why this is important. But if you look around and you think, okay, our organization's already pretty engaged with diversity more generally, I think they will be receptive to the message that we've been talking about here. And you can hopefully start to get people on board. So how you get people to kind of engage on a daily basis in what they do, I think really needs to be quite a systematic approach. And it comes back to this accessibility maturity model. You know, there's a lot of work being done on what good practice and good embedded accessibility or, you know, approach to diversity or digital inclusion looks like. There are quite a few strands or elements to it. And so that maturity model is something that I would invite people to. There's several of them. Just search for accessibility maturity model and you'll get some, you know, they're all relatively similar, but they kind of break down what elements you need to have in place within your organization to really know that you're kind of covering the bases. And when they're in place or when they're kind of forming, then you'll start to see the benefits of it. You'll start to see better documentation, better guidance, better training within those organizations to help you whatever your role is in your day-to-day work, be able to bear in mind and have the tools to hand to help you do things a bit better. Even if it's something as simple as turning on the accessibility checker or knowing where it is in Office, say, so that you can do a quick sanity check before you hit send on a particular PowerPoint or even email, is a simple thing to do. And it's built into every version of Office 365, which most corporates are on these days. And whether the corporate policy is to turn that on by default, that, you know, that would be a massive step in the right direction. And yeah, once it's got the level of seriousness ascribed to it from the highest enough level, then proper decisions, you know, sensible decisions will be made about procurement. You know, you're not going to be purchasing the kind of cheapest option when it comes to a particular application or product or service. You're hopefully going to be stipulating accessibility as well. And everything will be moving in the right direction.
And I guess my last question is maybe a personal one, not hopefully not in a bad way, but I think, you know, if we look at performing arts organizations that we work with, for example, we work with lots of theaters, and lots of them will have, for example, audio described performances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd be able to take Hugo, your guide dog, into the auditorium and experience the art that way. And it feels like the cultural sector sort of understands how to deliver more accessible cultural experiences that way. But that is very confined to the specifics of the performance and being physically there. As a blind man who has a guide dog and accesses the world through screen readers and a variety of other technical things, what's my question? Is the fact that there's an audio described performance enough if there are other barriers to accessing tickets, to accessing information about the performance? I suppose my question is, are we as a sector, as a cultural sector, is the fact that there have been moves towards making the art, in inverted commas, more accessible, not enough? Because it's clearly not enough.
It's certainly core. If I'm desperate to go and watch a particular performance at the RSC, which is I'm lucky enough to have just down the road, then it will be audio described. There will be performances that I'll be able to go to that have the headset and audio description. So that's brilliant. If the way of booking that, those tickets, and in particular of identifying which seat you want to sit at, because that's particularly poorly done by many organizations where it's all very visual and click on this to, you know, and the information about how far from the stage you are, or, you know, visibility, if you've got some vision, you know, is very difficult. It's not well conveyed in an accessible way. If I'm keen enough to see the performance, then the main thing is that the performance is accessible. And if there's flaws in all the stuff around it, then if I'm keen enough, I'll get eyes to help. That's the kind of at the core, kind of cutting back to the absolute minimum. That's what I would say. For me as a blind person, I need to have audio description. For, you know, if you're hearing impaired, there'd need to be a signer, or there'd need to be the live captioning on a little screen at the side of the stage or whatever. If you're in a wheelchair, then it needs to be physically accessible, and they don't want to be on the back row, right at the back, guys. They want to have a choice of places to go. My sister, if she ever wants to go to the local theatre, right at the top, right at the back. That's the only place that wheelchairs can go. But yeah, if the performance itself has those bases covered, then we can enjoy the art, the actual creative process, and everything else can kind of be got around with some support. Obviously, if the performance itself isn't accessible, then we might as well not be there, or we'd get very poor value for money or a very poor quality experience. But having said all that, there's absolutely no reason why the rest can't be accessible as well. This isn't rocket science. It's not going to cost three times as much. 2-5% on a new build is what they reckon it would cost to build in accessibility from start to finish. And the return on that, because you've got a much more inclusive product for all the things that we've been talking about earlier, all those reasons, the return will be much higher than 5%. So definitely it makes business sense. Yeah, so it's not an either or, but at the core of it, you need to have, you know, and whether that extends to something like a spoken narration as people walk through a museum, each exhibit and stuff like that, if there's somebody there that's able to go around with you, then that's fine. That's a reasonable adjustment. But if there's a tech alternative, then, you know, it needs to be fit for purpose. So if I'm going around a museum and you've got the spoken track as well, then that's fine. You'd think that that would tick the box for a blind person, and it does partly, but it then says, now go to the next, you know, now go to exhibit number 14, or, you know, a particular, the next stage of the journey through the museum. But how do we get there as a blind person? How do we know when we've got there? You know, so to have just a spoken narration of what you're passing isn't enough for a blind person if they're going to experience that completely solo. So yeah, and that's where thinking around the out of the box and thinking around the problem and actually getting end users involved would be absolutely essential.
Yeah, and that feels like sometimes that's the part of the conversation that's missing. It's a lot of creating experiences on behalf of other people rather than with the people that are actually going to be engaging with those, and actually having those voices as a part of the conversation feels essential. And I'm always surprised how many people working in digital capacities in cultural organizations have never seen someone using a screen reader, never understood what different types of color blindness do to how your design appears on a screen. Suddenly all of your beautifully color-coded seat map is completely meaningless because everything's the same color.
And just something like touch sensitive things, whether it's a touch screen or a touch panel in a lift or a touch sensitive flush thing, or not even touch, you kind of wave your hand in front of it in a toilet, are an absolute boon for people with a physical difficulty, for example. But for a blind person, it's a disaster. So you need to get all the groups involved, make sure that they are engaged and make it happen. You know, talking about the lifts, an example would be Braille on an otherwise flat kind of touch surface in the lift to choose which floor you want to go to. And the Braille is to the left, for example, of the area where you have to touch, because visually there might be like a white square around the thing that you have to press, and it's just kind of painted on, or it's underneath the glass or something. So they think, okay, let's put some Braille on here, but we won't put the Braille on the bit you have to press because, you know, maybe it lights up or maybe it doesn't look good for sighted people. I don't know why. So they put it to the left, and there's absolutely no indication to the, you know, it's otherwise a featureless piece of glass. You know, how do blind people know that the thing they actually need to press is an inch to the right of the Braille floor number? So things like that, you know, they mean well, but because it's not being road tested, it's just, you know, it's pointless.
And I guess just to finish, maybe, how do you feel positive about how things are changing? Does it feel like the trajectory is towards making things more inclusive and better? Or are we stagnating? Are we patting ourselves on the back for a job that's half done? Or are things getting worse?
I'm very, very positive, but also aware that there are huge challenges. And anyone with a disability using the internet, I say in most general terms, you know, websites, apps, all that sort of thing, living the digital life, will know huge frustrations on a daily basis. So it's even in that context, I'm still really positive and really enthusiastic about what tech brings to us. But the development of certain things, the rise of touchscreen-enabled devices, which used to have physical buttons, do present problems for some groups and opportunities for others. So it depends, is the answer, whether all the concepts that we've been talking about up till now get factored in as people create new products and, you know, new things, new trends come forward. So yeah, the touchscreens, you know, you can go to McDonald's and order your meal without having to go to the counter and talk to somebody. But at the same time, you can go to the counter and talk to somebody, which is good. But it's as soon as things that aren't completely inclusive are the only channel. And we're seeing that with, you know, digital services or companies that provide services online, where certain discounts are only available if you do it online, or the service is only available full stop online. So if the Uber app or the Lyft app, for example, weren't inclusive, then we're locked out of that whole revolution. So yeah, it's really important as new technologies, new trends, new advances arise over the next decade, say, that we don't get left behind. I can't at the moment think about one thing that will you know, that's a really worrying trend. Apart from maybe touchscreens popping up everywhere for blind people, I know we're a subset, a small subset of the disabled community in general, and the ability to have UIs on a lift or on an ATM or something, which are touchscreen, so the buttons, you know, with the touch of a button, a virtual button, which is a problem, but anyway, with the touch of a button on screen, the whole keypad could be made much bigger and much more high contrast, and you could have symbols instead of text. All the capabilities that a touchscreen provides, still is a massive obstacle there for blind people. But the answer would be to make sure that all of those devices are able to be operated and interfaced with by another device, like, for example, your smartphone, which you've already sorted out the accessibility on. And we're seeing that with white goods in the home. The new microwave you buy or washing machine or whatever might have a touchscreen instead of buttons, but you don't actually have to ever use it if you don't want to, because you can ask the A-lady to start a, you know, 60-degree whitewash or something, or defrost chicken, £3 or whatever. You know, you can do all of that, or you could use the app on your device. Now, I know that means you've got to have those devices and there's a barrier there, but at least there's a proliferation of choices of technologies that are interfacing with these appliances and things while you're out and about. You know, hopefully we'll get to the point where it's not unusual that you could have a choice about how you interface with devices both at home and out and about. And I'm looking forward to getting my first pair of A-Lady enabled sunglasses, for example, when those Amazon frames come to the UK, because wherever I am, I'll be able to query all of her different services and smartness. And if that means checking whether my front door's locked or if I've left the lights on, regardless of whether I'm at home or not, I'll be able to do that. So yeah, I think we live in exciting times. I think everyone's excited about, well, no, I can't say that, but a lot of people are very excited about technology, and it's becoming more accessible from a kind of a simplicity and usability point of view. You know, you don't have to read a manual anymore to know how to use a product. You don't have to worry about keeping your antivirus up to date or anything like that. So they're becoming more intuitive. And hopefully they're going to be inclusive going forward as well. And we're certainly in a different place today than we were 10 years ago, where disabled people had to buy everything specialist at great expense. Now all of those are either built into the products off the shelf, or you can get an app. There's an app for that. So yeah, it's exciting times. If everyone listening is a bit daunted about the prospect of doing their bit and trying to, you know, engage or embrace or get to grips with inclusive design, then I would say don't think that you have to go it alone. Go to whoever in your organization is the person who is responsible, who wears that hat, because the more people that ask for help with getting up to speed with it, the more those resources and energies will be put towards making, you know, empowering people within the organization. So yeah, don't feel like you have to do it yourself. Get somebody else to show you how to do it.
So that was Robin Christofferson, or rather I'm doing him a disservice, because he has actually received an honour. He is Robin Christofferson, MBE, an honour that he received for his services to digital inclusion. He's been named as one of the world's most 100 influential people in digital government. He has received special awards at the Tech for Good Awards. He is a judge at the Global Mobile Awards. You know, he is an expert, and hopefully you can tell from the conversation that we just had, an incredibly warm, lovely human being. I really enjoyed speaking with him. And Em, I know you found his session at DigitalWorks last year really impactful, and hopefully you enjoyed listening to his interview then. What's your perspective on what he had to say? What really sort of stuck out for you in terms of important things that you think people should take away, or perhaps things that challenge preconceptions that you might have had?
Yeah, I enjoyed listening to him again, actually, because his talk last year was just mind-blowing. It really made me realise that I'd sort of got everything a little bit wrong, to be honest, because I sort of went into it thinking that, you know, these products and services that people are designing aren't being designed for people with access needs, but actually to listen to him talk about navigating his day-to-day life and the difference that technology has made to his life, I just made me realize I had it all wrong. Like that's what's, it's technology that's enabled him to navigate the world almost completely unaided. And it was amazing. And there's all sorts of apps that he was using that were being his eyes. And I just, that was the main thing that really struck me, was that I had just completely got it the wrong way around. And I am a bit cynical sometimes with sort of the A-lady and things like that, where I think, oh, it's just collecting data and spying on us, and you know, technology is just making people lazy. And actually, that's just me and my experience. Like for someone like Robin, technology is giving him like a whole new like way to navigate the world. And that was the main thing that I took away from it.
Yeah, and I think that last point that you made is perhaps most pertinent to the people I assume are listening to this podcast, because I think we are all guilty of at times failing to be sort of able to understand things from anyone's perspective other than our own. And you know, when I spoke to Robin in the interview about what were the characteristics of organizations that did this sort of thing well, it was interesting and actually on reflection not surprising that he highlighted the issue of diversity, because if you have a more diverse group of people, you have a greater diversity of perspectives and experiences, and therefore the perspectives that are being brought to bear on any one scenario or conversation are inevitably going to be broader and richer, and therefore you're going to be able to really see the value of things like making your experiences fully accessible, you know, designing with inclusive principles in mind. However, if it's just a group of, you know, able-bodied people who share a similar educational or demographic background, who all live in the same part of the world and, you know, have similar lives, inevitably the outputs, the decisions that are made by that group are going to be constrained by the lack of breadth of experience.
Yeah, I agree.
I think both you and I can see why sometimes areas like this perhaps don't get the attention that they should, because, you know, in this environment where funding and resources are ever diminishing, inevitably institutional perspectives switch to sort of short-term survival. And I think that things like, you know, digital maturity, maturity around inclusion, true diversity of the workforce, all of those things are perhaps less easy to fix quickly, and maybe organizations see the benefits of addressing those agendas in inverted commas as being less of an immediate priority than keeping the lights on. However, I think Robin did a really good job of explaining, actually, you know, if you're addressing all of these areas, if you're really taking advantage of digital tools, if you're really being truly inclusive, if you're really embracing diversity, then there are going to be commercial business benefits that are going to be reaped from that. And that's going to put the sector in a much more resilient, to use the Arts Council's phraseology, a much more resilient position for the long term than simply worrying about how we're going to keep doing what we do at the moment for the next 6 or 12 months.
Absolutely. I think that word maturity is something that we've, you know, you're talking about digital maturity, and we talk about that quite a lot. And that you know, we've worked with teams where there's one person in the whole organization who's responsible for digital, and actually more recently we've met teams where that's no longer the case. There isn't one person looking after digital, because it's now being embedded across the organization. They're trying to think more digitally and have some digital maturity. And at Digital Works itself, at the table I was sat at, we were sort of talking about whether they were access champions in you know, the attendees organizations, and there was a split sort of 50-50 split, really, of people who either said, no, we don't have anyone who's sort of responsible for accessibility. And then the other side of the table who were like, oh, we do. And it was either we have one person who champions it eternally, or we are all now responsible and we're building it into our day-to-day. And I think it's, as you say, it sort of comes back to budget constraints and time and things like that. And there were a few people who'd said that actually with budget cuts, that was one of the positions that had dropped off, which was a bit of a shame. But yeah, you know, as you say, you can kind of see why that happens. But it's that maturity is the key word there, really, because it has to be embedded across the organisation for people to make it part of their day-to-day job.
And the slightly disheartening and frustrating thing is when I spoke to Robin at DigitalWorks last year, and I was talking to him about which were the organisations that were doing this sort of thing best, and the list of people that he shared, or the list of companies that he shared with me, were perhaps not who you might expect. So he said Barclays were absolutely fantastic. He highlighted Spotify. He said that Facebook actually has some really good accessibility tools baked into the platform. And, you know, banks, social media, and music streaming platform are perhaps not the types of organizations that you might expect to top a list of, you know, digital experiences that are really putting accessibility at the heart of the things that they do. And it feels like a bit of a shame and a bit of a missed opportunity that for such a sort of values-driven, mission-driven sector, the one that we all work in, with people who are all looking to have a positive, meaningful impact on the world and society, that accessibility and inclusion isn't higher up the agenda for everyone. And and I mean, you and I were sat next to each other at the Spectrix conference last year, and we both listened to Jess Tom give the fantastic closing address at the conference, which felt like something of a galvanizing moment for the people in the room. But I mean, what's your perspective? What's it going to take for the organizations that we work with, that we interact with, that we love in this sector, to be able to more meaningfully engage with this area of work?
I think it's sort of what you just said, really. It's a sector that is so driven by values and mission, and maybe that's the problem, is they've forgotten that, because they're in it's the experience business, isn't it? We're all about experiences, and we can't really talk about being about experiences if we're excluding a whole portion of our audiences. Because I can't quite remember the stats, but Jess Tom's session, I think she said something like 22% of people identify as having access needs. I might have that stat wrong, but that's what I probably should check my facts first. But that's what I remember. And I remember being surprised, thinking, oh, that's actually quite high. But she sort of shocked everyone in saying, oh, you know, it's almost impossible for someone with access needs to book on, you know, 80-odd% of your websites. And I think if people want to start improving this in their organizations, I think it's that we have to stop thinking of it as a box ticking exercise. And I think actually listening to Robin and why he's so good is what you said at the beginning. It's his personal experience and him speaking from a really personal point of view about just what a difference to his life it makes implementing something which we might not have thought of, that makes a massive difference to how he can use a website. The capture form example was a great example, where he was showing everybody in the room what his screen reader does when it finds a form with a capture, you know, one of those scrambled capture things on. And it was virtually impossible to understand what was going on, and he wouldn't be able to progress onto that website. And you just think, no one would think twice if they'd never heard that about having a capture form. And yeah, I think it's getting people in and remembering what their what their values are, what they're trying to do, and not just think, oh, I've got these tick boxes I have to tick for my funding, or because the board have said, or because it's now like legislation.
Yeah, and I think that that's, you'd hope that that shift in perspective, that shift in the way that people are engaging with this, is going to lead to longer lasting change. But, you know, you touched on there the fact that legislation now exists to ensure that organizations' digital experiences are meeting a certain level of compliance. There have been numerous examples, actually more so in America, of cultural institutions being successfully sued because their websites weren't accessible. But again, that feels like it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that the threat of legal action is the thing that's driving the agenda. It should be the fact that, you know, we as a sector are trying to reach as many people in as meaningful a way as possible. And in the digital space, the way to do that is by ensuring that your tools and services can be accessed by everyone.
And really, digital should be the perfect vehicle for that, because, you know, that anyone should be able to access something that's digital if they've got, you know, access to the internet or whatever, you know, websites you can get on your phone, on the bus or at home. And that really is the perfect place where we should really be putting access at the forefront.
Yeah. And I think coming back to the point we made earlier, that it's, you know, unless you're using assistive technologies or you have a disability or you have color blindness or whatever it might be, a tremor, you have an additional need when it comes to accessing digital services. It can be difficult to fully appreciate all of the component parts that can impact on the quality of that experience. And so I would sort of encourage everyone to experience what it's like to navigate your website or a website with a screen reader, or check, you know, do all of your videos have subtitles? Even things like the internal choices that we're making around digital, I think, are meaningful and impactful. I have a direct experience of that. When I was first talking to Robin and the initial call that we had, I set up via GoToMeeting. And rather embarrassingly, Robin then informed me that GoToMeeting is really very, very difficult to use if you're blind. And because when you join a call, you're automatically muted, Robin spent the first 5 minutes of our call trying to work out how to unmute himself, which is, I felt terrible that I'd inflicted that experience on him. And you know, I quite simply hadn't thought about how is this going to be to use if you can't see, and if you're using a voice assistant to access this piece of software. And similarly, when I was sending information about the event to Robin in advance, suddenly then, after the GoToMeeting debacle, I was very mindful of the format of the document that I was sending him, you know, a Word document rather than a PDF, because PDFs can sometimes be a bit not play nicely with screen readers. And really, this, to be fully accessible, to be fully inclusive, it does need to impact all of your thinking, all of your actions, all of the choices that you're making. But to come back to Robin's point, in doing that, I'm now being far more mindful about the way that I engage in my digital activity. And I think probably as a result, there is a better quality to that activity.
Yeah. And that ties back into what we were saying earlier about how there's a lot of similarities with sort of representation, because if you have people in your teams who perhaps do have some of these access needs, then that's somebody who can show you what that's like. You know, if you have people on your team who are not all the same as you, then they can prove to you how different their daily life is to yours. When, like you say, even just working, even just jumping on a call, or, you know, reading a document with a screen reader, like it sort of goes hand in hand, really.
Yeah, and actually today, Chrome, the Google's browser, have just released a whole new load of dev tools. They're called, so, tools for developers, but they are accessible by anyone who's using Chrome, and they allow you to simulate different types of visual impairment, different types of colorblindness. The tools that the browsers are now building into their software around accessibility are increasingly sophisticated. So I would really encourage everyone listening to this to go and check those out, because that starts to give you an insight into what it's like if you don't have perfect vision, if you are using some assistive technology. And I think that, you know, with everything we've described here, potentially sounds a little bit daunting. You know, it's, if you're not an expert, if you're not using assistive technology, then you might feel that you don't know where to start. But I think, as Robin said, it's about acknowledging that and just trying to educate yourself and trying to make things better one thing at a time. And inevitably, there will be easy and quick improvements that you can make. You know, are you putting image descriptions on all of the images that you're putting out on social media? Are there meaningful alt tags on all of the images on your website? It just little things like that have a hugely impactful effect on the experience of you know, a not insignificant minority of your users. As you said earlier, Em, there's a huge proportion of the UK population that has a disability of some kind. And, you know, it, again, from a purely business sense, it doesn't make sense to make it difficult for almost a quarter of your potential audience to interact with you.
Yeah, especially when, you know, we're talking specifically about digital. For most of those people, their first interaction with you will be the website. So if their first interaction with you is that they can't engage with you at all, then you've lost them. And probably deserve to, really.
You know, this is an area that we're, I think, both really passionate about. And I'm certainly not sitting here as someone who knows it all. I've still got a lot to learn. And I think that the pace of technological change is obviously, when you listen to someone like Robin, hugely exciting. But also I can appreciate from an organizational perspective, that's also another daunting factor around all of this. But it feels like, you know, this is something that our sector has to engage with more meaningfully, because there are only going to be benefits from doing that for everyone, from users, audiences, visitors, through to you know, the bottom line. But I'm really interested to hear about people's perspectives on this. You know, what are the challenges that you're facing in your organization around starting to do more of this activity or do it better? Do you have a person or a team of people that are experts and can advise you on the choices that you're making around digital tools and activity? Is that a gap that needs to be filled by someone, you know, servicing the whole sector? I don't have the answer to that. I'm interested in hearing people's thoughts. And so now is probably a good time to share our social media details. So you can get us on Twitter. We're at @digital_works_. And I am on Twitter at @biglittlethings. And Emily is on Twitter at @bemilyc. So that's Emily with a B at the start and a C at the end. And if you want to find out about future Digital Works events, we have got one coming up on the 20th of May at the Goethe Institute in London, where we'll be discussing digital storytelling. That is assuming that the coronavirus doesn't shut the entire country down. But at the moment, it's still going ahead. There are a few tickets left, and details of that can be found on our website at substract.com/digital-works. But thank you for listening. Thank you to Emily for the second time today, giving up a chunk of her afternoon to talk about this.
No problem.
And thank you to Robin Christofferson for so generously giving up his time to discuss this with us. If you want to get in touch with Robin, you can contact him through AbilityNet, which is abilitynet.org.uk. And he is also on Twitter at USA2Day, USA Today. And apparently there's a story behind the Twitter handle, but I forgot to ask him about it. So if you're interested, ask him. The next episode of Digital Works, I plan to record once again in an actual studio once I'm released from my quarantined state. And that will feature an interview with Carty Price, who's head of digital at V&A. But until next time, goodbye.